You have just stepped into the office. The ink is dry on the contract, and your LinkedIn is likely a flurry of congratulations. It feels like the beginning of a long journey. But here is the counterintuitive reality. Your window to establish yourself is much smaller than you think. While you might have a 90-day plan in your pocket, most of your stakeholders, your boss, your peers, and especially your new team, will form a working opinion of your leadership capability within the first few months. We often think of leadership as a marathon where we can find our stride over many months. But in a new role, it functions more like a sprint to establish trust. Research shows that these early impressions are remarkably durable, and if you spend your first month rushing to fix things without understanding the floor plan, you might find yourself fighting an uphill battle for credibility that lasts your entire tenure. This is particularly true because 60% of new managers have never received formal training. You are likely relying on the instincts that made you a star individual contributor, the drive to solve problems, the speed of execution, and the desire to be the smartest person in the room. But in this new role, those very instincts can become your greatest liabilities. If you've inherited a difficult team dynamic or a business that needs to scale, the pressure to perform can lead you into a trap where you overfunction and inadvertently signal to your team that you don't trust them. We are going to look at why the most powerful move you can make in your first 14 days is actually a strategic retreat into listening. We will explore how to diagnose the structural breaks in a team that has been burned before, and how to use three specific questions to uncover the truth of what you've actually inherited, regardless of what you were told during the interview process. By the end of this, you will have a playbook that doesn't just help you survive the transition, but helps you build the kind of psychological safety where your team starts solving their own problems, so you can focus on the future. Let's start by looking at why your expertise might actually be your biggest hurdle. There is a fundamental shift that happens when you move from being a doer to a leader, and if you don't catch it, it will sink you. As an individual contributor, your value was defined by what you personally produced, the code you wrote, the sales you closed, or the projects you managed. But as a manager, your value is now defined by what your team produces and how much they grow. This is the identity trap. You got the promotion because you were the best on the team, but Google's Project Oxygen research found that technical expertise actually ranked dead last among the behaviors that define a great manager. The top behaviors were actually coaching and empowering the team without micromanaging. When you enter a new role, especially one with a difficult team dynamic, you will feel a desperate urge to prove you deserve the chair. You want to show everyone you're the sharpest person in the room. This leads to what we call the savior trap, where you try to fix everything at once, work 14-hour days, and personally review every single deliverable. You think you're being helpful, but you're actually absorbing your team's problems instead of teaching them to solve their own. This creates a dependency that is exhausting for you and demoralizing for them. In fact, if you've inherited a team that you didn't build, which 67% of managers do, they are already asking themselves, why should we follow you? They have their own inside jokes, their own unspoken rules, and perhaps a lingering loyalty to the previous manager. If you rush in with a savior mindset, you are essentially telling them that their previous way of working was worthless. This is why the first 30 days should be about diagnosis, not surgery. You have to realize that a challenging team isn't usually a collection of difficult people. It's a group of people responding to a collapsed system. They might be protecting themselves by doing the bare minimum because they've watched leadership fail before. If you try to assert authority too early, it feels like pushing a boulder uphill. Instead, you need to earn the social license to lead by showing that you understand the landscape before you try to change it. This brings us to the most critical tool in your first 2 weeks, the listening tour. The single biggest mistake new leaders make is moving too fast and rearranging the furniture before they understand the floor plan. To avoid this, you must commit to a period of strategic restraint. In your first 2 weeks, your job is to shut up and listen. This isn't passive. It is the highest yield work you will do all quarter. You need to schedule 30-minute one-on-ones with every person on your team, but these aren't status updates. These are diagnostic interviews designed to find the patterns of dysfunction that were likely obscured during your hiring process. During these sessions, you should ask three specific questions. First, what is working well that I should protect? This signals that you aren't there to destroy everything they've built. Second, what is the biggest obstacle you face right now? This helps you identify the structural breaks in the team's rhythm or clarity. And third, if you were in my role, what would you change first? The key here is to listen and take notes without reacting. Do not promise fixes yet. Do not share your opinions. Just collect the data. You will start to hear contradictions. For instance, your boss might have told you the team lacks drive, but the team tells you they are burnt out by an approval process that adds 3 days to every task. That contradiction is where the real truth lives. While you are listening to your direct reports, you also need to map your stakeholders. This includes your boss, your peers, and those quiet veterans who actually know how things get done. Every organization has a formal org chart and a shadow structure, the real way decisions are made over coffee or in certain Slack channels. You need to understand both. Ask your peers what they wish someone had told them when they started. Ask your boss, what would make you worried in 90 days? By the end of week two, you shouldn't have a plan yet. You should have a map. You are looking for the cultural fog, where goals are vague, or the meeting drift, where people are exhausted by aimless updates. Once you have this map, you can move from listening to aligning, but you must do so with a focus on trust. In the first few weeks, your team is quietly deciding one thing. Is it safe to be honest with you? This is the concept of psychological safety, which is the shared belief that the team is safe for interpersonal risk-taking. If you want to scale a business and manage difficult dynamics, you need a team that surfaces problems early, rather than hiding them until they explode. Research from Wharton suggests that trust is built on two distinct pillars, warmth and competence. We trust warm people because we believe they care about us, and we trust competent people because they are effective. Most leaders lean too hard on competence. They use jargon, highlight their credentials, and try to be overcompetent. But if your competence is already established by your title, showing a bit of vulnerability can actually bridge the trust gap more effectively. You might admit that you don't have all the answers yet, or share a story of a challenge you've faced. This models fallibility, which gives your team permission to be human too. However, warmth without competence is just softness. You earn real credibility by pairing that warmth with clear standards. If you've inherited a team where performance has drifted, you need to address the dialogue gaps, the hard conversations that the previous manager likely avoided. Month two is the time to establish your leadership rhythm. This means setting a predictable cadence of meetings and one-on-ones. People don't actually resist structure. They resist structure that feels arbitrary. If you explain that your weekly check-in is a sacred hour for their development and coaching, they will value it. If you treat it as a status report, where you micromanage their tasks, they will resent it. The goal is to use these interactions to start giving positive, specific feedback within 24 hours of a good behavior. This builds a psychological safety net that makes the harder, constructive feedback you'll have to give later much easier to hear. By the time you reach the middle of your second month, you have enough context to stop just listening and start acting, but you must act with precision. This is where you identify your quick wins. These are not random improvements. They are strategic moves that share three traits. They solve a specific pain point the team mentioned during your listening tours. They are visible enough that people outside the team notice, and they don't require stepping on anyone's existing work. Think of a quick win as a down payment on your future strategy. If your team told you that a specific approval process is a nightmare, and you managed to streamline it, you have just proven that you listened and that you have the political competence to get things done in the larger organization. This buys you the credibility capital needed for the much harder changes you'll want to make in month three, like performance management or a strategy pivot. But be careful. The trap here is the popularity trap. You might be tempted to say yes to every request just to be liked. Real respect comes from clarity and consistency, not from being the cool boss. If you say yes to everything, you'll eventually frustrate your high performers because you aren't holding the low performers accountable. Instead, use your quick win to signal the new standards. For example, if you fix a meeting that was a waste of time, you aren't just saving an hour. You are signaling that you value the team's focus and that you expect meetings to be high impact. This is also the time to have your "what I've learned" conversation. Bring the team together and share the themes, not individual comments, from your listening tour. Say, "I heard we struggle with X, and here is how I want to address it." This closes the loop and proves that their input actually shaped your priorities. As you move toward the end of your first 90 days, your role must shift from being the person who has the answers to the person who asks the right questions. This is the essence of coaching. The savior trap we talked about earlier is often fueled by a fear that if you aren't directing every move, things will fall apart. But the research is clear. Leaders who challenge and inspire, what Liz Wiseman calls multipliers, extract twice the capability from their teams compared to diminishers who try to control everything. To scale a business, you cannot be the bottleneck for every decision. You need to use your one-on-ones to build the decision-making muscles of your team. Instead of giving a solution when a team member brings you a problem, try asking, "What have you tried so far?" Or, "What is the ideal outcome here?" This shifts the burden of thinking back to them. It might feel slower in the moment. This is the perfectionism trap, where you think you could do it faster yourself, but over time, it creates a self-reliant team. This is also when you should start looking at career conversations. Most managers wait until a formal review to talk about growth, but if you want to earn deep trust from a difficult team, you need to show that you care about their long-term trajectory. Try the life story approach. Ask them to tell you about their life starting from kindergarten. It sounds odd, but it helps you identify the core values that drive them. Are they motivated by autonomy, status, or learning? When you understand someone's dream for 10 years in the future, you can help them find projects today that build the skills they need for that dream. This transforms the relationship from a transactional one into a partnership. You aren't just their boss. You are the person helping them build their future. One of the biggest surprises for new leaders is that they often have less freedom than they did as individual contributors. You are now part of a web of interdependence. You need cooperation from IT, HR, and other departments you don't formally control. This is the political reality of organizations. Many managers view politics as a dirty word, but in leadership, politics is simply the way you secure resources and protect your team. In your third month, you need to widen your lens and build your strategic network. These are the people who help you prepare for the future. If you turn inward and only focus on your team, you will eventually find yourself unable to protect them from unreasonable demands or timeline pressures. You need to be a bridge between your team and the rest of the company. This means managing up effectively as well. Your boss should never be surprised by what is happening on your team. Establish an upward communication rhythm. Maybe a weekly email with progress on priorities, emerging risks, and decisions you need from them. When you bring a problem to your boss, don't just dump it on their desk. Bring an analysis, alternatives, and a recommendation. This shows that you are taking ownership of the outcome. At the same time, you must protect your team's focus. A major part of your job is saying no to cross-functional requests that don't align with your team's mission. If you've done your landscape mapping correctly, you'll know which stakeholders have the most influence and whose priorities might conflict with yours. Leadership is not just about what happens inside your team meetings. It's about how you position your team in the larger organizational story. Now that we've explored the philosophy and the pitfalls, let's look at the concrete steps for your transition. In weeks 1 and 2, your focus is entirely on diagnosing before you touch anything. Complete your listening tours, build your stakeholder map, and identify those structural breaks like cultural fog or meeting drift. Resist the urge to perform or fix. Your only output in week 2 is a deep understanding of the shadow structure and the real pain points of your people. In weeks 3 and 4, you synthesize what you've heard. Draft your recurring meeting cadence and share the themes of your listening tour with the team. Identify that first quick win, something visible and fixable within 2 to 3 weeks. By the end of month 2, you should have explicit alignment with your boss in writing on your top 3 outcomes for the quarter. Month 2 is about proving you can execute. Implement your meeting rhythm, complete your first quick win, and start the habit of giving regular positive feedback. This is also when you start to address one structural inefficiency, maybe an approval bottleneck or a pointless status meeting. Month 3 is for locking in your strategy. This is when you formalize your 6-month vision document. It should be a simple one-pager that answers, where are we going, why does it matter, and, most importantly, what are we saying no to? Share this vision with your boss first to get alignment, then with your team. This is also the time to have the hard conversations you've been postponing. By now, you have 90 days of data on performance patterns. You know who is struggling and which dynamics are unhealthy. Address them directly and compassionately. You've earned the right to lead. Now you must use it to set the direction for the future. We have covered a lot of ground, from the savior trap to the art of the quick win. But I want to end on the emotional side of this transition. The first 90 days can feel terrible. There will be days when the gap between what you know and what you need to know feels like a canyon. You might feel like an imposter, especially when managing a difficult team that is waiting for you to trip up. It is important to remember that this discomfort isn't a sign that you are failing. It is a sign that you are growing into a bigger role. Confidence in a leadership transition isn't a starting condition. It's a byproduct. It builds as you accumulate small pieces of evidence that you can do this. A decision that landed well, a team member who finally spoke up in a meeting because you made it safe, or a quick win that removed a long-standing frustration. You don't need to feel confident to act confidently. You just need a plan and the discipline to follow it. Your job is no longer to be the best player on the field. It is to be the person who ensures the field is set up for everyone else to succeed. If you approach these first 3 months with intention instead of impulse, you will come out the other side with a team that trusts you and a foundation strong enough to support whatever you build next. I want to thank you for spending this time thinking through these concepts with me. As you head back into your new role, I encourage you to pick just one thing from this playbook to try this week. Maybe it's booking those listening tours, or maybe it's just asking that one extra question in your next one-on-one. Leadership is built in those small, intentional moments. You have the map. Now go run the playbook.